Case number 20-5233, Campaign Legal Center versus United States Department of Justice, appellant, and case number 20-5234, Campaign Legal Center versus United States Department of Justice, appellant. Mr. Sinstak for the appellant, Ms. Olin for the appellee.
Thank you, Mr. Sinstak.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Jerry Sinstak appearing on behalf of the Department of Justice. Plaintiff in this case seeks drafts and embedded editorial comments on a letter that was sent by the Department of Justice to the Department of Commerce in December of 2017. Those drafts and the embedded comments within them are both pre-decisional and deliberative, and therefore squarely qualify as protected by the deliberative process privilege. They are pre-decisional, as the declarations submitted make clear, in the sense that they predate the final and official copy of the letter that was sent in December 2017. They are deliberative in that they reflect the give and take of the agency consultative process regarding what material should be included in the letter, what material should be excluded, comments and questions and analyses of the letter itself and so forth. And therefore, they plainly fall within the deliberative process privilege. The district court concluded otherwise, on the ground that they were not pre-decisional because they postdated the decision to send a letter. That is incorrect. As I mentioned, the deliberative process here is the deliberative process that culminated in the final version of the letter that was sent, in the official version of the letter that was sent to the Department of Commerce in December of 2017.
Once the letter itself was finalized, so events after that would not be protected.
The only relevant decision
you flagged here is.
Yeah, I mean, there could be, you know, as Your Honor is well aware, I mean, there could be, you know, if there were press inquiries, that might kick off a new deliberative process about how to respond.
But none
to those,
of these documents are about that.
No, they're not. They are drafts of the final letter and an embedded commentary from Department of Justice staff on the letter.
On your view, what is the relevant decision to which these documents are pre-decisional?
It's the official version of the letter that was sent on December 2017. That's the official letter from the agency embodying the decision.
And do we, so I'm not sure anything turns on this, but I'm just trying to get straight in my mind what the decision is. Should we say that the Attorney General's decision that DOJ would send the letter was a final decision, but then there was a second final decision about what the letter would say? Or should we think of it as the Attorney General's direct decision to file something was not final because maybe he would have changed his mind?
Your Honor, I agree with you. I don't think anything turns on this. I think one could say there was a deliberative process that led to the decision to send a letter, as there often will be, but there was certainly a separate or an additional, or one could think of it as all the same deliberative process over what the letter should say, what its content should be. And that culminated in the final letter. So I do think it's true. There was really no final official action here until the letter went out. And so in theory, the Attorney General could have changed his mind at any time and not sent the letter. But even if one were to conclude that the Attorney General had made up his mind and was not going to be convinced otherwise, there would still exist a deliberative process over what the contents of the letter should be and so forth and so on. And for that reason, these documents fall squarely within the deliberative process privilege.
Mr. Sinstak, how do we think about finality for these purposes, like what a final decision is? I mean, the Supreme Court's recent decision in the Fish and Wildlife case from earlier this year, repeatedly suggests to the Bennett v. Speer test for finality. And I'm wondering whether you think that is the type of inquiry we should use in FOIA cases.
I mean, Your Honor, I hesitate to say that because I don't think it's the same test that might apply in an APA action. I mean, whether Whether this letter has a real operative effect or creates legal rights, that's a separate issue. I don't know. But I think what this court has said in cases like the Dudman case, for example, you know, which involves an official history by the Air Force, that you know, this is the official position of the agency. This is its sort of culmination of you know, of its views or of the decision making process. So I think in that sense, this letter was the official letter. I don't know that it would meet the test for Speer in terms of at least it would in the sense of a culmination of the decision making process. I'm not sure it would, you know, for the purposes of whether it would be subject to APA review as a final agency action.
So you don't think those tests are coterminous?
I mean, I guess the answer to that question, I mean, I'm hesitant to answer because I don't know what the department's official position would be on that. I do think when you're talking about drafts of a document, whether that, you know, when you have the final official document, that's relevant for purposes of FOIA, whether that document would in and of itself be final agency action for other purposes. I don't think that's necessarily the case.
Couldn't possibly be final agency action under the APA. It's just...
Exactly.
DOJ's advice to Commerce. The final agency action is Commerce passing a reg or not, adding the are you a lawful resident or are you a citizen or not to the census.
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't think it would qualify in that sense, but I don't think that's the sense this court has used the term.
It is interesting that the Supreme Court repeatedly cites to the Bennett test in discussing that. So.
Yes, and you know, I think
and references legally operative effect.
Right, and but I think one thing that's clear here, you know, whatever test one applies to the final letter, certainly the drafts of that letter weren't documents that the agency treated as the final word or the official word. These are drafts circulated by staff of the department and comments and so forth from those staff members, and certainly nothing. You know, whatever the final letter might qualify, certainly these drafts weren't treated by the agency as final and not subject to further change.
Certainly with another Supreme Court decision in the Commerce Department case that said the decision to claim that this question would promote the enforcement of Voting Rights Act was contrived, in the Supreme Court's words, a contrived decision. If an agency head I'm making something up, it's completely false, but I'm going to say it. I'm going to go out to reporters and I'm going to lie through my teeth because I don't want to tell them the real reason. Draft me up some lies. Are you aware of any case in the common law that applied the deliberative process privilege to that time, where it's not, you're not really making a decision. There's no decision to be made. If the guy's already said, I'm exaggerating here, of course. The Supreme Court was softer in his language, but I'm, for hypothetical reasons, agency head says, I'm going to lie just for kicks. I'm going to lie. I'm not making any decision here. Give me some lies. But that's the deliberative process that's protected by the common law privilege.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not aware of cases either way. I'm not aware of a case court saying it is or isn't. I know there, well, I guess I, obviously, as Your Honor knows, that wasn't the circumstances here. And I think it would depend, you know, when you look at the declarations and you look at who was involved in the drafting process, there's no reason to think that the individual staff members were anything but sincere in their efforts to deliberate about this letter, including, which could include, you know, critical comments about the letter and its purpose. So from their perspective,
I'm just asking you though, like to have kind of reconcile the Supreme Court saying that this was a contrived decision with the coverage of the deliberative process.
Well, first of all,
if I were to tell you that there were cases kind of going different ways, some would say that's just not covered in common law by the deliberative process privilege. Are we supposed to apply those?
No, Your Honor, because I think as this court has said in cases like National Security Archive, I mean, what the point of the privilege is to protect staff, for example, or individuals who are participating in the consultative process to be able to provide their candid advice and so forth. So
was this letter providing advice to the Attorney General? Or was it just?
Yeah, I mean, the attorney general, I think one way of looking at
how to articulate the attorney general's conclusively determined position.
One way to look at it is that attorney general, even assuming he made the final decision, then he delegated to staff the equally important considerations about which arguments to make in support of that decision and what justifications to proffer and to get advice on how to do it and so forth.
But I think the substance that it was going to be to help enforce the Voting Rights Act, that was already predetermined as well. And so
it feels more like
how are we gonna message that? The decision's been made, how are we going to message it?
Well, I think that is a common feature. I mean, if we just to use the Reporters Committee case, for example, I mean, James Comey decides to send a letter to the editor and decides to defend the policies of the FBI, there still remains a deliberative process exactly how to go about doing that and what the content of those communications. And
do we stick with our policy, our old policy that's under fire? If we want to keep it, how are we going to keep it? There wasn't a fake policy or anything like that.
Well, I think I don't want to fight the comment too hard. I think the Supreme Court actually said there was nothing inappropriate about any of the individual steps in the process. And so if we're talking about deliberations among staff of DOJ about what goes into this letter, I don't think there's any reason to assume the Supreme Court thought that the staff members were engaged in anything other than a sincere effort to provide their candid comments.
No, it could be I made it extreme to make sure we're in hypothetical land. We're really not talking about that, which is obviously the case in front of, just to understand the contours of the process.
And I think
privilege, but if what they're really not doing, they're really not advising someone. Decision's been made, here's how you do it, voting rights. But they are, sincerely trying to figure out how best to articulate that. I didn't see that in your affidavits. It just seemed to sort of say pre-decisional, this is pre-decisional, it was draft, it counts, as opposed to explaining for us, what kind of deliberations, substantive policy deliberations still were to be made. I can imagine all kinds of them, but it's not my job to imagine them because I could be wrong. They're supposed to be in the declarations, but they're not.
Well, I guess I would point, for example, the declarations for JA 406 to 410, for example, in which there are explanations of,
Hang on, let me catch up with you.
Sure. I'll hold it myself.
All it says is we're writing a draft.
It says, we are offering analyses, suggested edits, contemplating strategies.
It's just boilerplate language for any draft. I bet you that shows up in lots of affidavits.
I think there are
particularized helping us to understand what was still being deliberated, what the concerns were.
Well, certainly I think it is contained.
Really,
sure, I can point to more examples, but I think what is being debated, as explained here, is what is the content of this letter? How can we make it more persuasive or stronger? Or this is something that's going to be viewed by others. And you see, it notes that it includes, and I don't have the exact date for this, but analysis by staff of the letter. Comments asking for clarification, raising questions, and so forth. And I think that clearly indicates that they're still debating what this letter should say, red line, proposed edits, what are the justifications?
Yeah, I get that they were drafts, right? I get all it does is say these were drafts, right? Drafts have red lines, edits, comment, bubbles, nits, those types of things. But there's nothing here. Again, I can imagine a lot in my head as to what people would want to be careful about in articulating something like this for all kinds of strategic reasons. But I'm imagining that in my head because I didn't see anything in your affidavits that told me, what kind of concerns. You could say safely without revealing content, what kind of concerns were being addressed.
I mean, perhaps they're not as clear as they could be, but I would.
No, they're not. They're not beyond boilerplate. It's not clear. There's nothing there that wouldn't show up in every single affidavit for a draft something or other. If there are particular parts of any of these affidavits, particularly in the OIP one, that you can point me to that help me understand in this scenario where a final decision had been made to ask for the question and to do for it on the grounds of Voting Rights Act enforcement. If you can point to me, take those as a given.
Mm-hmm.
Where well, there's something here that doesn't show up in this particular rest of these cases, doesn't show up in every other affidavit like this, every other draft document FOIA affidavit. That would be really helpful. But I can, you can do that on rebuttal.
Okay, I can do that on the break.
Time now. Yeah.
But I do think the policy, you know, the justifications and contents of a policy announcements are as important as the, you know, they're integral to the policy itself. So a debate about what, you know, what should be included and what shouldn't be do implicate policy concerns. And I'm happy to answer any further questions.
My colleagues don't have questions. I have a particularized couple, but I don't want to keep on JA 608 to start. This is the Civil Rights Division's Vaughn Index. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So the dates go very sweeping here, December to December 2017. And we all know that at some point, anything after December 12th for sure, but certainly sometime during the day on December 12th, things stopped being pre-decisional because that's when the letter was issued. And it describes in the end of that first paragraph there that a few emails discuss the logistics of transmitting the Gary letter by fax and email. Can we agree that once you've got final sign-off and someone's just figuring out whether to do fax or email, that that's not a pre-decisional part of the drafting process? Or if not, point me to an affidavit statement that explains how on earth that is part of the deliberative process.
Yeah, I mean, if all we're talking about is the logistics of transmitting it, you know, unless mm-hmm. there's some, you know, I suspect I'm not going to fight you on that point.
Okay.
And that may have been something that was released, because these are just suggesting that parts of the emails, but to the extent it wasn't.
Well, this is just right. I don't know. If they were withheld, though, that would be, it's not clear at all to me, because
yeah,
we
I
don't
mean,
have the unredacted
to be clear, what we're,
documents that this was not redacted. So you're not you're not saying that.
No, to be clear, the thing we're defending here are the drafts of the letter, the comments included, the cover emails, which also included comments, you know, of a piece.
When they do that, but you're not defending things that are just talking about the logistics, the timing, or the which mechanism to use. Are we certain? And if that's
I'm not certain. I would assume we're not, but you know, if it's simply just send it by fax or not. I mean, I know I was reading the record and you know, we're going to fax this was, I think, one of the emails, you know, that was disclosed. So I would assume that not.
It's
I mean,
not clear
I,
to me, but
that any event, I apologize for that, but the focus here is
it
on.
It shows up numerous times here. It shows up again on JA615.
Well, and we did disclose a number of things that are, you know, only partially redacted, for example. So I can check if, but the focus of the appeal is not on those.
Yeah. Okay. I was concerned about that. So, okay. There are other ones of emails that seem to be talking about timing, and then there's a block out, and it's not at all clear to me, given these Vaughn Index descriptions, whether that what followed that was talking about timing, fax, email, or whether that was talking about a whole new deliberative process, something that would fall within the deliberative process here. So it seems to me it's a little bit, there's a lot of confusion to me, at least, between these Vaughn descriptions. And
the Vaughn, you know, indices covered a number of documents, but many of which were released, some of which were released in response to the district court's opinion in this case. And I did go back to an earlier question. I mean, I think we see in the following paragraph, you know, these emails discuss edits, comments, and revisions. The emails also discuss draft versions, formulation of additional questions to elicit relevant information, and numerous edits and changes. These emails contain questions and responses.
Weirdness of that other line in there, right? Everything else is describing stuff you're withholding. It would seem weird to have a sentence in there that describes something that you're releasing.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I'm raising that paragraph in part to note, you know, to respond to your honest questions about, you know, descriptions of what's contained that, you know, in these drafts and comments and edits.
Oh, yeah, but there's nothing particularized there, right? I think we can all agree that every time you claim the deliberate process for a document, you're going to say for a drafting process of a document, because it was drafts, it was comments, was questions, it was transmissions. But this one is an unusual case where you know,
I guess
the big decision's already been made, as well as at least some level of content decision. It'll be the Voting Rights Act. And so,
but as
helping courts and the public understand, because the Vaughan Index serves a public accountability process to help us understand what the type of decisions making that was left to be done is. The policy decision making.
Yeah, and I guess what I would say the policy is regarding the specific contents and justifications and so forth that appear in the final letter.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Celine? Good morning, Your Honors. Elizabeth O'Lean for the Appellee Campaign Legal Center. The court should uphold the district court's findings that the drafts and emails at issue in this unusual case are not pre-decisional and not privileged for three reasons. First, withholding the documents would undermine the aim of FOIA to open agency action to the light of public scrutiny and provide a check against corruption, because the Gary letter sets forth a contrived and pretextual justification for an already made decision. Second, the documents are a functionally final decision in draft form and thus not pre-decisional. And third, disclosure will not harm or chill the internal agency process because the Department of Justice was not engaged in policymaking when it drafted the Gary letter.
If the Attorney General had said, I am not sending a letter, I am not requesting a citizenship question, this is hypothetical, obviously, I think it would damage our enforcement of the Voting Rights Act or some other statute. We are not doing it. That is my final decision. And it's my final decision. I'm making it because it's going to harm civil rights enforcement. Go draft that letter to this team. Would drafts of that letter also be released?
Yes, those drafts would also not be pre-decisional, because in your example where the Attorney General said to write a letter saying that we will not support this rationale is essentially the same as the facts that we have here. What happened in this
case, how do you distinguish that from Reporters Committee, right? Dr. Comey said, I'm going to do an editorial, let's get it written. And it's do an editorial defending our practice. Let's get it written.
Yes, so the distinguishing point between the reporter's case and this case, as you wrote, Judge Millett, there is no allegation that Director Comey was providing any sort of direction or explaining the basis for a final decision to his subordinate in these emails.
Wait. That was sort of in the sentences and the details, but there was no question that he had made clear there's going to be an editorial and it's going to defend our policy. That's a direction to them. They didn't have discretion to make that what the substance of it was going to be. It seems to me identical to my hypothetical.
So it is different, Your Honor. And the reason that it's different is in this case, not only did the Attorney General direct his subordinates to write the Gary letter, he also directed them the rationale to provide. So unlike Director Comey, he did provide direction explaining the basis for the final decision. And
what about when the Solicitor General authorizes an appeal? And that process will identify what issues can be raised on appeal, what cannot be raised on appeal, what arguments are made. And the Solicitor General signs off and says, appeal, which means to the litigating appellate staff, go write the brief consistent with the directions and the memos. So does that mean every draft of a Justice Department brief authorized by the Solicitor General is also post-decisional?
No, Your Honor. And I think a key difference here is that the Attorney General did direct the staff to use a specific rationale, but he also was not engaged in policy making, in agency-oriented policy judgment when he made that determination. At the very beginning of this matter, to take a slight step back, the Secretary Ross had asked his staff to reach out to the Department of Justice and other agencies to find someone willing to support his position. The Department of Justice did engage in a deliberative process where they considered the voting rights rationale, and the staff determined that that was not something that they could support. It then went back to Secretary Ross, who said, I want this to happen. There was a call scheduled between Secretary Ross and Attorney General Sessions. Just prior to that call, the record reflects at 190 that there was an email between the Department of Justice staff and the Department of Commerce staff, and the Department of Justice wrote, it sounds like we can do whatever you need us to do. The AG is eager to assist. So that email, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Ms. Helene, why does any of this matter to whether there's actual policy making? I mean, I understand your position is that something unsavory happened here because political appointees disagreed with the staff and made a decision about what should happen here. But so, I mean, in a context in which you think that the decision making is not appropriate or is somehow fudging, I mean, are you suggesting that you get a kind of super FOIA in those cases? You know, you get kind of extra FOIA even when they are actually deliberating and going through a process just because the policy is ultimately not one that is one that you agree with? I guess I'm not really sure what all of this is related to with respect to whether something is deliberative. I mean, people are deliberating, maybe not in the way that you think is appropriate, but I'm not sure how that takes it out of the deliberative and pre-decisional box.
So to answer your first question, no, we are not advocating for a super FOIA, and I don't think that any sort of super FOIA is necessary here. The emails and documents are properly disclosed under the law as it exists today. In order for something to be pre-decisional, which it was the only prong that the district court got to, it would be a document that was prepared to assist an agency decision maker in arriving at his decision rather than to support a decision already made. And here, based on the facts, we know, particularly as evidenced by the email from the Department of Justice staff to the Department of Commerce staff, that the decision for the content of the letter was already decided. There was already a decision from the highest level of the Department of Justice that a request would be made to the Census Bureau to add the citizenship question, and that the rationale for that would be enforcement of the Voting Rights Act. And
Ms. Helene, isn't that, as Judge Millett was also discussing with her example of the Solicitor General, I mean, isn't that a very common feature of government decision-making, where a senior official decides, makes a decision about what's going to happen, maybe the primary arguments that are going to be made, but there's still a lot to be worked out in the details.
Your Honor, this case is very different from, and it is very unusual, and it is not like any of the other cases in the existing precedent where that could be the case. The facts that we have here and the record that we have here includes a decision from the Supreme Court that was written by Chief Justice Roberts, in which he characterized the Voting Rights Act rationale as pretextual. So it was not, in fact, the actual reason for the decision. Any discussion that would have been occurring in the drafting of the Gary letter would not have been about an agency policy decision.
I didn't see this type of argument in your brief. I saw you arguing that the decision had already been made and the rationale had already been given. This was all post-decisional, and they weren't claiming that this was a messaging case. I didn't see you arguing that instead there's a question about whether the deliberative process privilege applies at all in the case of, for example, hypothetically, a false or fraudulent agency pronouncement. I just didn't see that. I didn't see any cases or discussion about the common law history of the deliberative process privilege. So it sounds now like you're trying to say this is sort of unique for precisely those reasons.
So Your Honor, on page 8 of our brief, we did address this briefly, and we said that the Gary letter itself does not reflect a typical agency process for formulating a process as the department.
It may not be typical, even, you know, things aren't always typical. Editorial drafting isn't always typical either. I didn't see you arguing that it's a matter of the common law deliberative process privilege that Exemption 5 brings into the FOIA. It just doesn't apply. You take it as applying, but you just say it's not, the terms aren't satisfied here. This is, you said it's, this is post-decisional. Come on, this is post-decisional, and there's nothing really deliberative going on.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. And
that's a different argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can I give you a hypothetical, which is the government is deciding whether or not to take an appeal involving the Department of Commerce. And a lot of the line lawyers in DOJ are recommending against appeal because they think the government's position is very difficult. Secretary of Commerce calls the Attorney General and says, this is really important to us, please help me out. Attorney General says, I understand, I'll do it. The Attorney General tells the Solicitor General, this is really important, you need to do this. The Solicitor General authorizes the appeal and gives general direction. We're going to take the following position. It's one sentence. On that hypo, would the draft DOJ briefs implementing that decision be protected?
The draft DOJ briefs would be protected.
Okay, how is that different from this case?
So that is different from this case because in the hypothetical that you provided, there would be latitude amongst the DOJ staff to craft the arguments. And the difference here is that there was not, I think the situation—
You don't think there's latitude from the Attorney General says, we're going to send a letter taking the position that this question would help voting rights enforcement. And the end product, which is a 3-page letter that reads like a substantive, very substantive legal analysis. It could be like the summary of a brief. And, you know, some lawyer in DOJ decided that Reyes versus City of Farmers Branch was a good case to cite for some proposition about citizen voting age population. You don't think there are legal judgments in going from the direction of the Attorney General to this final product?
No, Your Honor. I'm sorry. Yes, but the distinguishing factor in this case is that the content of the Gary letter was not the actual reason, the actual policy reason for the request for the citizenship. And it was not specifically called out in our brief, but it is in the record at page 376. There is a memorandum from the House of Representatives who had done an investigation, and their investigation through the interviews revealed to them that the actual purpose of this request had to do with redistricting and an attempt to entrench a political party in power. So the Gary letter, as the Supreme Court found, was simply a pretext. It was not describing an actual policy decision of the department. And this is further demonstrated by the fact that after the Census Bureau received the Gary letter, they reached out to the department to confer further, like in Fish and Wildlife, there was an expectation that the draft would be provided to EPA and they could discuss it back and forth before reaching a final biological opinion. In this case, the Census Bureau reached out to the department and the department, as the Supreme Court found, showed no interest in further discussing this matter.
Then you are advocating for a different standard, right? Because if Judge Katsas's hypothetical would be covered by the privilege, but this letter is not, then you are asking for a different standard in the context where some external party thinks that the decision-making is pretextual or inappropriate, right? You're asking for a different standard based on the substance of how the decision was made. Because you're saying in the one context where it's a brief, like that's, so there's some kind of honest, you know, decision-making process and that's covered. But if it's a pretextual decision-making process, or if someone thinks it's a pretextual decision-making process, that is not protected by the privilege. I mean, that's the distinction you're drawing, isn't it?
Yes, and I would qualify that by saying that the purpose of the deliberative process privilege is to protect the agency decision-making process rather than to protect decisions that are already made. And
what if the State Department or the CIA for national security reasons said, we need to issue a letter that says the reason we are drawing down our embassy staff in country X is because of COVID concerns inside the embassy. And in fact, the reasons are much more complicated, and it is all a ruse to cover up the fact that there is, say, an impending military action by the United States or an ally. So it's an pretextual explanation is going to be given by a national security agency or a foreign relations agency, because that's the best way to protect the interests of the United States of America. And they say, go draft that. The drafts of that, because they're pretextual, openly within the agency known to be pretextual reasons, would they be available? Would they be protected or not? You're saying they would not be protected because they're pretextual.
So I have to admit that I am not familiar with national security law.
You don't have to be. This is FOIA law. So just FOIA. With the deliberative process privilege under FOIA, your exception that you want to make for pretextual agency decision-makings, would that apply then to a press statement issued by the national security or foreign relations agency that was pretextual?
Correct, Your Honor. So assuming that there is not some other statute of which I'm not familiar with.
We're assuming there's no other exemption applicable. This is all we got, one way or the other.
Yes. So I think then the key place to focus is the three aims of the deliberative process privilege. And I think in your example and in this example, the three aims are instructive, and I think that you would reach the same outcome because the purpose of FOIA is to shed
same outcomes as you're asking for here. So we would release the drafts of those drafts of that press release or press statement.
Right, and so the three points.
Even though those drafts would be saying things about here's the real reason we're doing it, but we can't say that. So let's try saying it this way. And then someone says, well, we can't say it that way because that's going to spill the beans on some other operation we have going somewhere else in the world. So let's rewrite it this way. All those things are going to come out because the enterprise, the exercise itself was pretextual.
Again, Your Honor, I think it would come down to, in your hypothetical, a question of whether the State Department was actually engaged in policymaking. And in your example, it sounds like there were real policy considerations and concerns. What would drive the analysis would be whether there was any danger that the subordinates would feel inhibited by their opinions. And in this case, the internal discussions there would not be, because they had agreed up front, long before drafting started, months before drafting started, that they agreed to the decision and the voting rights rationale. There would be no danger of a premature disclosure of a policy that had not been finalized, because in this case, again, the decision was made up front, the rationale was decided up front. And there would also be no danger of confusing the public about the reasons or rationales in this case. Again,
so Ms. Olin, your position then as a legal matter is that it's a document is only deliberative and pre-decisional, not just because it's deliberative and pre-decisional, but if it's deliberative and pre-decisional and serves the policy purposes of that protection. So judges then have to determine not only whether something is in fact deliberative and pre-decisional, but also whether it meets the policy purposes behind that protection.
I don't think that it necessarily matters as much whether the document meets the policy purposes, and maybe I'm misunderstanding your question, as much as whether it reveals an agency's or an official's mode of formulating or exercising policy judgment. That was not the case here. Enforcement of the Voting Rights Act was not a policy of the Department of Justice. It was, as the Supreme Court found, a pretextual reason for a different policy, which was redistricting. And that was what was not described in the Gary letter. I think it would be a very different circumstance if the Gary letter described the actual policy reason, which was the redistricting. Because it describes a pretextual reason that we now understand was not the reason for the letter, I think that's the difference.
I don't understand the relevance of that, because Supreme Court said that the Department of Commerce's decision, while not itself unreasonable, was pretextual because the DOJ voting rights position didn't reflect the actual reasons why the Department of Commerce wanted to add the citizenship question. So, okay, maybe the Department of Commerce wasn't being as candid as it could, but I don't understand, why does that tend to suggest that within DOJ, when the Attorney General says, we are gonna take the position that this question would be helpful for voting rights enforcement, why would that tend to show that the DOJ lawyers who were left to operationalize that decision were doing anything other than what DOJ lawyers do every time they operationalize the appeal decision by working on the brief?
Correct, Your Honor. So I think the answer to your question goes back to the first question that you asked of Mr. Sendak, which is, what is the operative decision here? And I disagree that the operative, my client disagrees that the operative decision is the decision to write the letter. The operative decision is the Attorney General's decision to make the request and to use this rationale. So at that point, it has removed the discretion from the staff. And so so that's the difference. I'm not sure I quite answered your question.
That's an answer to my question, but it doesn't distinguish every single DOJ appeal where the SG does exactly the same thing on the front end.
Again, Your Honor, I would submit that the key difference here is the fact that the decision and the rationale were not the actual policy of the Department of Justice. In the briefing that you've described, you know, in your hypothetical, ostensibly the arguments that they are putting forth to the court would be the Department of Justice's actual
voting rights. The voting rights angle was the actual position of the Department of Justice.
The record reflects that it was a position that the department did not support. They had actually considered the staff.
But it was the decision of the Attorney General.
That is correct. That is correct, Your Honor.
And then the line attorneys were charged with operationalizing it.
That is also correct, Your Honor. But the distinction is the decision point, because if the decision is the Attorney General's decision to give this order to his staff, then the Gary letter is a post-decisional document. And they had no discretion. Whereas if, as the department argues, the Gary letter is the decision and the contents of it are the decision, then it wouldn't be. But it's our position, as the district court found, that the operative decision is the Attorney General's decision. So the Gary letter is necessarily post-decisional.
Colleagues, have any further questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Aleem. I'll give Mr. Sindak 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the only thing I have really is, you know, a response primarily to Your Honor's earlier questions about drafts. You know, I have a number
of eyes to this case.
You know, I have a number of pages to cite. I think they're of a piece with what I had quoted earlier in terms of, you know, on page 456 of the JA, drafts were circulated for additional review and input.
Let me catch up.
Oh, sorry about that.
I don't mean to eat your time up by turning pages. Okay.
Yeah, you know, this is the middle of paragraph 30 or the end of it. You know, they contain questions to list of relevant information, comment bubbles, edits regarding the final contents of the letter for determining the final contents. You know, the next page, 457, they talk about there being opinions, comments, edits, and recommendations. You know, there's similar wording. I know Your Honor is going to say that was, you know, typical of other.
If you can represent to me that that's atypical language as opposed to.
Well, I think what's typical in
language
sense,
in every deliberative process affidavit, I'd love to hear it.
Well, I think they are similar, in fact, very similar to declarations submitted. For example, in Machado, Amadis, I think if I'm pronouncing it correctly, quoted language very similar to this as being satisfactory. I think the implication here is that, you know, we have the final letter. We know the arguments that were made in that letter, and these are comments and suggestions and edits and so forth, questions about what those justifications should be and so forth. And that implicates policy because, of course,
the affidavits in Machado, I'm saying that right, in a lot more detail about the specific process.
I guess I'm, but
there's a specific process and they named the process and how it all worked internally. And that's not here at all. This could be any FOIA affidavit for any agency doing.
Well, I guess, I mean, when an agency is settling on its official position and publishing its reasons for that position, for example, of course, I think
but here,
drafts and deliberations going into that.
It's still the same, but here what you had to do was sort of say, look, even when a decision's been made that we're going to do this and a rationale has been given, it's still important within the government, important decisions still have to be made.
Regarding what the justifications are, what the support for. So, you know, what the support for that position.
I've already told you the justification, the Voting Rights Act. So,
well, what specific arguments, what material should be included, what material should be excluded, what facts, what cases should be cited, how long the letter should be, you know, how it should be phrased, and so forth.
I mean, you're a better talking affidavit than I got here.
Well, I apologize that wasn't made clearer. I think that's the implication of these comments. And you know, we have a number of cases, for example, like Krikorian, where, you know, there were person drafts of a letter and those were considered deliberate.
I'm just saying, we know from Machado that agencies are actually fully capable of giving us more granular agency-specific explanations than what we have here.
I appreciate that, Your Honor.
Any other questions for my colleagues?
You are content to have us decide both deliberation and foreseeable harm on the current affidavits. You didn't have the benefit of Machado when the affidavits were written.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I would point out the unforeseeable harm issue hasn't been briefed by or decided by the district court or briefed by the parties.
Hasn't even been raised by the plaintiff.
But yeah, I mean, I think the deliberative, we are comfortable with the deliberative. I mean, that was briefed. You know, we did brief that and the declarations are.
Great. Thank you. Thanks to all. The case is submitted.